This is Career Buzz, Canada's unique radio conversation that empowers lives, enriches careers, and energizes organizations. I'm your host, Mark Franklin, practice leader of a team of professional career counselors at CareerCycles.com. Thanks for tuning in this morning. So many of us now watch TED Talks for inspiration and learning. How do the speakers get selected? Emma Brooks' day job is as a digital strategist with publicist Modem, where she works with clients like Rogers Metro and Chrysler Canada. But her volunteer gig for the past 4 years is with TEDx Toronto, most recently as director of programming. Drew Dudley's TED Talk, called Everyday Leadership, has been watched by a million people. Drew is the former national chair of Canada's largest fundraiser for post-secondary students called Shinerama. He's founder of Nuance Leadership and now works with organizations to develop their leadership capacity. Emma Brooks and Drew Dudley join me in the second half of today's show. But first, Fast Company magazine called her a career guru. Dr. Barbara Moses is president of BBM Human Resource Consultants and author of career books, including What Next? Find the Work That's Right for You. She's been quoted and profiled in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, NPR, and Canada AM. Barbara's counseled people in over 2,000 organizations. And on Career Buzz, we'll draw on her experience talking to these clients to shed light on today's career and workplace realities. Barbara Moses joins me live in studio. Welcome, Barbara.
Hi, delighted to be here.
Glad to have you. Glad to have you back, in fact. You were here some years ago.
That's correct.
And thanks also for making some book giveaways available. So we have a couple of copies of What Next, and in about 15 minutes, we'll open up the lines for comments and questions, and people can call in and win one of the two copies. Thanks for that.
You're welcome.
Now, some listeners will know you from your Globe and Mail column. In your blog post last week, you announced you were going to give up that column in favor of a blog. What do you like about having your own blog?
Editorial freedom. You can write as many words or as few words as you're required to tell your story. You can write when you want. Also, when you're writing in the career section for the ROB, it has to have a clear business implication. I'm a psychologist. I'm interested in the total person. So while it was very interesting to do that, I do like to explore areas which are the interface between work, society, and life, whether that's the impact of work demands on children's healthy development, for example, or the impact of work demands on stress, or the impact of children's disappointment on how people feel about themselves.
Right on. In fact, I'm going to ask you a little bit about the question you posed at the end of the blog, can you teach an old dog new tricks? We'll come back to that one in a bit. But first, you've been doing so much over the years. You've been writing books and columns, creating an online career advisor site, public speaking, and helping clients. So in addition to the blog, what else are you doing these days?
I spend a lot of time gardening. I spend a lot of time doing what I describe as providing unwanted, unsolicited advice to people. In other words, I mentor a lot of people. I love mentoring young people, particularly women, particularly people who have a talent that they actually are unaware of, the really bright people who have an edge but just sometimes can't quite fit in and don't understand just how amazingly competent, creative, and talented they are.
Right on.
And when I mentor people, I like to go beyond what they're doing at work and how to get ahead, but it could be anything from dealing with their relationships, their kids, how they dress. As I say, I like to get involved in all areas of people's lives.
You've been fairly successful in your own career. What would you say are your top few skills or strengths that you draw on and have drawn on to be successful?
I'd say not quite getting it. It would probably be the simplest way. For example, I developed a career planning workbook, which was the forerunner of my tool, my online tool, Career Advisor. When I developed it in the late 80s, early 90s, at that time, all training manuals were these three-hole, remember those binders which weighed about 500 pounds
and
the company would slap its name all over the cover? I didn't know that, so I decided I wanted something beautiful. I hired a graphic designer, and by the way, I didn't have very much money. In fact, I had no money. I was married to, my husband is a writer, magazine writer. At that time, it was a recession, so that means there was few ads, which means very little stuff being published. But I just couldn't understand why you would take something that was personal and put it into something that was ugly and heavy. So I put it into, this doesn't sound like it's particularly amazing, but at the time it blew people away. I put it in a Surlock's binder. It was beautiful. It was lightweight. People had never seen it, and they kept on saying, well, the only way you can market that is by putting the company's name on it. And I said, no, because, and the same would be true today. When people are thinking about their careers and who they are, they don't want to be thinking about Air Canada or the bank or whoever it is they work for. They're thinking about themselves, how they represent themselves to themselves. And that's personal and that's intimate. And what I wanted to do in the workbook is capture my own voice in career counseling. So it wasn't the company talking to them. It was a human being talking to them.
Nice. And I like the way you put it. Not quite getting it is one of your strengths. You know, I ask this question a lot on Career Buzz because I want people to articulate their skills and strengths in just everyday language, because there's so many online tools and assessments that come up with arcane language, and I think the most powerful way to communicate one's strengths is to say it in your own words. So I love this, and I've been collecting a list of these kinds of weird, not weird, but just interestingly named skills and strengths. So listeners, may listeners borrow that?
Of course. Feel free.
That's great. Now, there's a lot of contemporary issues that you've been covering in the Globe and Mail column that you've been thinking about. Like never before, we have multiple generations in the workplace. So I'd like to start with that one and talk a little bit about the generational tensions you're seeing and how those generational tensions are affecting organizations.
Well, if I were to put it simply, I'd say each generation today sees themselves as the generation that got most screwed. Older workers feel, quite correctly, that they're treated largely with contempt by their organization, that younger workers are biting at their heels, waiting for them to retire. And they are the ones who actually, many of them, thought at this stage in their life they would be spending time traveling, making a transition to retirement. But they're the ones with decimated portfolios. They can't afford to retire, and they're caught. The younger workers, the ones coming up right behind them, those would be, say, in their late 30s, 40s, they see themselves as having been trained for those executive or senior management jobs, but they're being blocked by this group of people who are not retiring. Then you have a whole other generation who thought they would get it all. Their parents told them they were amazing. Teachers told them they were brilliant. These are, of course, the millennials or Gen Y or whatever you want to call them, people in their 20s and early 30s who find they cannot even get a foothold in the workplace. And they're struggling from internship to internship. It actually breaks my heart when I talk to some of these people who have 5 master's degrees and 10 internships under their belts who still cannot get a decent full-paying, regular-paying job.
Right on. My guest today is Barbara Moses, and you're listening to Career Buzz here on CIUT 89.5 FM worldwide, CIUT.fm. And listeners, if you have comments or questions as our interview is unfolding, we have a couple of copies of Barbara's book, What Next? So I'm going to give out the number in a moment, and you can call in with your comment or question. We'll put you on the air. We'll have a conversation about any of the issues that we're talking today. I want to pick up on the theme of internships, especially if we have people, let's say earlier career people who have been dealing with internships. We've had a few guests on Career Buzz who have talked about the unpaid internship and how long should it last and what should they do to turn that into a paid job, especially that one, but any other issues, we'd love to hear from you. So I'll give out those numbers in a moment. Barbara, on the earlier end of the spectrum, for people in early career, Generation Y, millennials, this idea of internships is a big problem. It seems like a good idea on the one hand. It gives young people experience in the workplace. It gives the employer a chance to kind of try before they buy, in a way. But it looks like this is becoming problematic, even abusing people. You hear all kinds of negative stories here. What's going on? What do you think is going on, first from the employer's perspective? Why is this happening?
Well, I think you put it very well. They're seen as cheap labor. So organizations think this is win-win. Someone can, at the end of 6 months or a year, have something to put on their resume, and in the meantime, they get cheap or free labor. Except, ultimately, organizations don't win, and the individual doesn't win. The reason why organizations don't win is because we are not developing a generation of people who have confidence in their ability. People who are interns know that they're basically cannon fodder, and they're treated as such. So they don't develop, the challenge in your 20s, basically no one really knows what they want to do when they're in their 20s, and that's no one ever tells you that, but that's the challenge for people in their 20s and early 30s, figuring out what you want to do when you grow up. But in addition, but at least in order to do that, you shouldn't have to be grappling with an ongoing series of questions, am I even okay? Because they don't even feel like they're okay because they're treated so poorly. They never feel that they can relax. They're always performing for the future. So they should be dealing with the big issues, not the sort of basic issues of self-esteem and worthiness.
You know, we had a guest on from Finland a few weeks ago talking about this very thing, and they had these same kinds of internships. And they ended up implementing a national program called the Youth Guarantee. And basically, if you were out of work or out of school for 3 months, this program swooped in and it got you plugged into something. And on the employer side, it provided 10 months internship and it was supported by money for the employer. 10 months, according to this guy, was long enough for Finnish employers to really get a feel for somebody, and then they could offer them the full-time job. It seemed like a win-win. It was just starting. We're going to check back in with Finland and see how they do. What should we do here? Is this kind of subsidy something that employers need, or are they going to figure out that if they don't start investing in younger people, they're going to really screw up their pipeline of talent pretty quickly?
I think you put it very well. And Mark, this is all sounding very familiar. I can't quite remember it, but I seem to remember that in the early or mid-70s, the government did something similar to give people who'd graduated from university, you know, an opportunity to get jobs. And I had to name the program, but I don't think the program lasted for a year or two, and then I don't know what happened to it. But I think if the organization is seriously committing to hire that person, assuming the individual can deliver, then of course it's win-win. But in the interim, and that would mean that the organization would understand that they have to treat this person with care and sensitivity, and they would need to develop them because they know that they're not ultimately disposable.
We had a story of a guy on the show, a recent grad from a well-known university in Canada, got a three-month internship, unpaid. It was renewed. The third time it was going to be renewed, he started to interview. And one day he came to work in a suit, which wasn't normal. And somebody at work said, well, Peter, what are you doing? Why the suit? He said, well, I'm going to interview. And the next day they offered him the full-time job. And it took that.
I've heard a similar story in the past, and I think that that's a great strategy. In fact, I was just coaching a young woman who was working for a communications company in media. She was on her fourth internship with this organization, and I said, just start acting like you're an employee and see what happens. And they start to treat her differently.
How did she act like an employee? That's an interesting perspective. What would she have done differently in the workplace?
She wouldn't have been. She used to be very tentative. You know, if you feel that you're ultimately disposable, then you're like a 5-year-old who's always trying to win the approval of mommy and daddy. But if you act as she should have, as a 30-year-old with 3 master's degrees, who's highly competent, and you don't ask for permission for everything, and you act like you deserve to be there, people will often, not always, treat you differently. Now, that said, sometimes it gets people's backs up. You know, people who feel threatened by it, who basically like the idea of a sycophant and having that kind of power over the young person who is apparently so sycophantic and completely dependent on this the older person for a job. It can backfire. So I'm not saying it's going to work all the time. But if I can just say one more thing, do you really want to work for someone who's a jerk?
Well, exactly. But sometimes you're in a more desperate situation and you feel like you need to. My guest today is Dr. Barbara Moses, president of BBM Human Resource Consultants. I'm your host, Mark Franklin, here on Career Buzz 89.5 FM and worldwide, CIUT.FM. I was mentioning earlier that Barbara had brought in 2 copies of her book, What Next? Find the Work That's Right for You. If you have a comment or question, especially about internships, we'd love to hear from you. If you've had internships, if you're an employer who has a perspective on internships, give us a call. We'll put you on the air and you'll get a copy of the book. The phone number to call is 416-946-7000, 416-946-7000. And Christina will pick up the phone and she'll put you on. So give us a call, 416-946-7000. Barbara, among the more seasoned workers, Gen X's, we've got trends where people are feeling pressured. They're feeling sometimes unhappy. We certainly hear it from a career counseling firm. You hear of the complaints, right? Because that's people don't come for career health and wellness. They come because they have career pain. It's out there, and people are feeling disaffected. What's going on? Why are they feeling that way?
I'm actually shocked at the record epidemic levels of distress in the workplace. A recent study showed that about 50% of all workers are suffering from anxiety and depression as a result of work. Gallup did a similar study in the States, found that 70% of people are suffering from extreme stress. Antidepressants, the number of prescriptions which are written, and it may be that there's a tendency now to overprescribe, but even if you take that into account, it has increased 400% in the past 20 years. All of which says that there is something seriously wrong. When I did my PhD in the early mid-80s, people were talking about stress as an issue. But at that time, it was an issue because perhaps 1 in 7 people experienced psychological difficulties as a result of their job. Today, it doesn't even make any sense to call it a disorder, because a disorder means that it's an unusual behavior. But if everyone's experiencing it, then it's no longer unusual. Now, think about what that means. Something which is clearly wrong, which is clearly unpleasant, which is clearly pathological, anxiety, depression, is now the new normal. That is really scary. I'll give you an example, and this is a kind of thing that I find very disturbing. Two recent examples. One was a woman I counseled, late 30s, who I would have described as the Energizer Bunny type. Type A, driven, very bright project manager type. Completely committed to her job. Who she was and what she does were the same thing. Chose to not have children, she and her husband, because work was the centerpiece of her life. She recently quit. She cited exhaustion as the reason for quitting. Another young woman who I've been counseling who, well, I would not say that work was a centerpiece of her life. It was clearly a very important part of her identity. Very ambitious. On a rapid career trajectory up the ladder. And she recently just said, you know, if I could make enough money walking dogs, and by the way, I've heard the walking dogs from a lot of people, I would do it in a heartbeat.
So it's really out there. I mean, we're hearing a little bit of a skewed perspective. I mean, you and I, we're possibly hearing the people who are complaining, and they're coming to us and other career professionals across the country. So, you know, there are lots of happy people out there in career land, but there is this trend of trying to do more with less. So the first story, exhaustion. This is the story, I'm just trying to do too much, too many hours of work. Like, what's going on? Is it just this more with less, and the employers haven't really found the recession has ended and they haven't hired anybody yet?
Absolutely. What happened is employers developed habits during the recession, and then they became ossified. They set in and people started to behave like it was normal. When my first book, Career Intelligence, came out in 1997, I prophesized and described a work world where people were working to the max. They felt they were units of productivity that could be disposed of at any time, that overwork, extreme work, busyness had become the new normal. And I remember the ROB described it as hyperbole. It wasn't hyperbole, except the only thing was I understated the case in terms of what's going on now. I don't know if you remember, around in the late 90s, if you'd ask someone, how are you? They'd say, I'm so busy. I'm so busy. But they wouldn't say something like, I'm so stressed, because stressed was still something pathologized. You wouldn't say it would be too intimate. Now people boast about, not about how busy they are, but how stressed out they are.
It's a scary story. Let's see what we can find in terms of responses and answers. If you're listening and have a comment or question, you can call in or email. Give us a call with your thoughts on the topics. 416-946-7000, 416-946-7000. Or drop me an email. It's Mark with a K at careercycles.com. Mark at careercycles.com, and let us know what you're thinking. So, Barbara, what are we going to do about this? People are dealing with these situations. One of your clients wants to be a dog walker, step away from the corporate world. People are going to have to make some tough choices, possibly. Do they stay or do they go? And if they go, they're going to have to think about changing their lifestyle. What are some solutions? What are some ways out of this?
Well, the first thing is people have to think about their work in the same way they would think about, for example, an abusive teacher for other child. If a parent heard that their kid was being ill-treated by a teacher, that parent would be at the school in a nanosecond. Yet, work plays such an important role in defining how we feel about ourselves, how effective we are, not only as workers, but as parents, as friends, as the children. Yet, most people abandon themselves to work, and they don't ask themselves routinely, how am I feeling? How am I doing? What did I accomplish this past week? What can I pat myself on the back for? What am my next week going to look like? Is my work meeting my values? And if you don't ask yourself those questions, then you just end up being sucked into this quagmire of work demands. And a lot of what people do at work is also garbage work. If they were to step back and think about how important is this? What would happen if I didn't go to that meeting? What would happen if I didn't respond to that email? Chances are nothing. So people also play a role in contributing to their business.
So they're complicit
they
in
are.
Some of their own complaints.
Yes. For example, a friend of mine, I took her out for lunch. We're at Holt Renfrew. She's on vacation. And she's during the lunch, she keeps on looking at her BlackBerry and swearing and saying, they know I'm on vacation. Why are they emailing me? And I said, look, idiot, it's because you're responding to their emails. So as far as they're concerned, you may be on vacation, but they know you're available to them.
So being more clear about what you want and don't want, setting boundaries, being assertive. I mean, if you're going to stick with your job, most people, you know, are scared to step away and become the dog walker that they dream of. So if they're sticking with their job, how can you be more assertive, clear with your desires without it seeming like it's all about you? Striking the right balance with the employer.
Absolutely. You don't want to come across as obnoxious, but if you were to say, for example, Mark, you've asked me to do this, but I'm also working on such and such. What is it that's most important to you, Mark? Because I cannot do both of these things. That would be a reasonable request, right?
Nice. Easy.
Yeah. Or if you were to say, I've been looking at the number of things that I've got on my plate, and some of these tasks are suffering. What is most important to you in terms of your priorities? Or else, just making the decision yourself, because the chances are your boss isn't even aware of the fact that he or she downloaded something, you know, one of 25 things a week ago. It's probably forgotten. So use your judgment. You don't have to get permission for everything.
Right on. My guest today is Barbara Moses. She's the author of What Next? Find the Work That's Right for You. I'm your host, Mark Franklin, here on Career Buzz 89.5 FM in Toronto and CIUT.FM worldwide. If you have some thoughts, comments, questions about what you're hearing, give us a call. You can dial us in 416-946-7000, 416-946-7000. We have a couple of copies of the book available, or drop me an email. It's mark@careercycles.com. So, Barbara, in that, was it the first blog, the June 19th blog? I was looking at it yesterday.
It was,
that was the first one, the inaugural blog. So I thought that this is a harbinger of some interesting stuff to come, no doubt. But then you tell the story of the, you know, can you teach an old dog new tricks? And it sounds like somebody changed your mind about that. At first you thought, no, you can't. And something happened. What happened?
Well, I've always believed that, you know, Scott Fitzgerald, I think it was, famously said, in America, there's no such things as second or third acts. And I actually always agreed. People usually do not wake up at the age of 60 and all of a sudden discover that they are going to be the great Canadian novelist or painter, photographer, or whatever, that they always had the capacity to do it, if they've never shown any inclination before that they could do that. About a year ago, my cousin, who has a postdoc in both experimental and clinical psychology and has had a successful career as an operations executive, called me up and he said, I have a manuscript. I just wrote a psychological thriller. My husband and I always dread that question because my husband's also an author, and usually we know we're going to see something that's just awful. And what are you going to say when the person says, Barbara, Andrew, what did you think of it? Because, you know, their whole life, it's so important to them. And so without having any expectation, or rather the lowest expectations of this novel, this manuscript, it turned out to be an amazing read. My cousin has never written anything before in his life. By the way, the book is called Jump.
Great. So it's interesting. You know, like I think I've heard you speak about this topic. I know I hear about it all the time. It's about you know, using your skills in new ways, you know, and it does scare people to do something completely different, whether it's the metaphor of teaching an old dog new tricks or reinvention. I know is a topic that people think, am I going to reinvent myself? And that's a scary word. Rather, it's using what you've got and doing it in different ways. Is that the key to making these significant changes?
I always say, and notwithstanding my cousin's story, because the chances are, if you haven't written by the time you're 60, you're not going to write an amazing book, that the key is to reconfigure, not reinvent.
Yeah.
First of all, you cannot reinvent the self. I really can't stand that word, reinvention, because it implies that somehow there's something wrong with your soul, the very essence of your being. There's nothing wrong with the essence of your being. People have in them all kinds of latent skills, which they express, but they express in different ways. I'll give you an example. Woman who was a very talented nurse, and then she ended up in a very senior role at a hospital. When she decided she no longer, she had drifted away from what she had always loved, which was nurturing. But she hadn't practiced nursing for several years. She became one of the most talented coaches and counselors I know. But it was basically doing the same thing. It was being nurturing.
Good example. I mean, that's the key thing, is drawing on the skills or strengths. If people are listening and they're facing one of those changes right now, they think they ought to take that step, right? And maybe the first thing to do is stop using that word reinvent, because it is scary and it can be, you know, harmful to the soul almost. But if they want to reconfigure, as you say, what are some of the steps? How do you get started?
Well, the first step is self-assessment. And the reason why I use reconfigure, think of your skills and aptitudes and psychological preferences as like pieces of Lego. So to take, for example, the nurse, the pieces of her Lego were nurturing, caring about people, being sensitive to them, being able to read them, having an understanding of what that person's life was about. So the first step, forget writing the resume, forget practicing for the interview. Know who you are and what you're good at. Be able, and this is interesting, to go back to what you first said to me about me not getting it. Talk in words, regular English. Do not use words like I'm a team-building, leadership-inspiring, motivating, blah, value-adding, blah, blah. It says nothing. It's content-free. Talk in words that anyone would understand. Your mother, your grandmother, your grandfather would understand. Put it into English. Who are you? What are you good at? What are the environments in which you thrive? Often, people who say they're unhappy with their work and therefore want to change careers, typically it's not the practice of psychology or accounting or law or whatever that's bothering them. It's where they're doing it or with whom. For example, they need more autonomy or less autonomy, or they're more thin-skinned and they need to work in an environment which is more nurturing. Or there's someone who's very driven and needs to have a lot of things going on at once, and they're working in an environment which isn't intense enough for them, or more likely, they are someone who needs to work on a few things at a time, put them to bed before they go on to the next project, but they're working in an environment where they've got 100 things on the go, so they're losing it.
Right on. So we've just got a couple of minutes left, and I want to let listeners know, I hope we didn't scare them off, but give us a call. We've got two books here. What Next? Find the Work That's Right for You. Give us a call, 416-946-7000, or drop me an email, mark@careercycles.com. And I think we have somebody who's just called in. Hi, caller. You're on the air. What's your name?
Shannon.
Hey, was it Shannon?
Yeah, Shannon.
What's your comment or question?
Well, I have a situation that's been developing for a number of years. I've been in a marriage for 13 years now. And my wife comes home from work with a ton of stress. And she's, you know, it's been affecting everybody in the family, including my 9-year-old child and our relationship. And she won't deal with it. She hardly even recognizes the fact that she has stress, and she's not coping with it very well. And she even can get free mental health care from her contract, labor contract, but she will not go to the counselor.
Well, Shanahan, great comment about that situation there. Tough situation. Barbara, what are your thoughts on the wife who doesn't even acknowledge that she's stressed, although she seems to be quite stressed?
Okay, I think in that situation, although we try to change the individual and try to get them to have insight into their problem, you can't change the individual and have them have insight. Your challenge is to deal with it, how to figure out how you can manage the impact of her stress. At the extreme, it may involve saying, here's how you behave and I can't deal with that, and here are the implications. Or it may mean you go for counseling and you learn how to respond to her. Or you keep your child out of harm's way if you feel she's in a dangerous or he's in a dangerous position. But you cannot get people to have an insight if they don't, if they repress it or refuse to see it or simply do not have the emotional capacity to see it.
Yeah. And it's interesting, the caller is talking about what sounds like an employee assistance program that his wife has. Many companies have it. The funny thing about that is so many people don't even know that that exists. They don't know, you know, maybe Shanahan, your wife does, but so many people don't even know it exists and yet they could get help through them.
There's no question. I mean, they're fabulous. They're not meant to replace a therapist or a psychologist, but to get immediate crisis intervention when you're just losing it, to have someone to talk to, and often you only have three or four, it's time limited. You can't talk to this person forever. But to be able to get advice when you need it and to have a neutral sounding board is fabulous.
Thanks for calling, Shanahan, and let Christina get your contact info for the book there. And if other listeners want to call in the second half of the show, we'll take your info and you can get a copy of What Next. Give us a call in a moment, 416-946-7000, or drop me an email. It's mark@careercycles.com. Barbara, we got to wrap up. Let me just ask you one kind of summary question. Back to the personal, given all the twists and turns and experiences that you've had in your career, what can you share with listeners about a thing or two that you've learned about making good choices, especially career, but you know, career and life choices, broadly speaking?
Take the time to think about what is important to you. Be reflective. Take your own counsel. That's probably the best advice I can give listeners, particularly women. Women end up being the victims of the counsel of their partners, their parents, and the first half of life, they're always trying to please others. Listen to that inner voice which says, I'm not happy. One of my books that I wrote was called Dish, Midlife Women Tell the Truth About Work Life and Work Relationships and the Rest of Life. And the number one wish that women express, and these were successful women, they wished they had taken their own counsel earlier.
Great advice. And if people want to read more about your upcoming blog entries, how do they do that?
Just go to my website and sign up. It's bmoses.com is my website.
Great. Barbara Moses, thank you so much for joining us here on Career Buzz.
Thanks. It was great. Great conversation.
Great. We're going to take a quick break for a piece of music. I hope we can cue up our theme music, actually. It's Manu Chao here, and then we'll be right back with two TED Talkers. Stay tuned.
Me gusta su cocina, me gustas de la mañana. Tú. Me gusta camelar, me gustas tú. Me gusta la guitarra, me gustas tú. Me gusta el reggae, me gustas tú. ¿Qué voy a hacer? Je ne sais pas. ¿Qué voy a hacer? Je ne sais plus. ¿Qué voy a hacer? Je suis perdu. ¿Qué hora son, mi corazón? Me gusta la canela, me gustas tú. Me gusta el fuego, me gustas tú. Me gusta menear, me gustas tú. Me gusta la Coruña, me gustas tú. Me gusta Malasaña, me gustas tú. Me gusta la castaña, me gustas tú. Me gusta Guatemala, me gustas tú. ¿Qué voy a hacer? Je ne sais pas. ¿Qué voy a hacer? Je ne sais plus. ¿Qué voy a hacer? Je suis perdu.
Continues. CIUT 89.5, Toronto.
We're back at Career Buzz. I'm your host, Mark Franklin, practice leader of a team of professional career counselors at careercycles.com. Before continuing on with today's show, I want to let listeners know we have an amazing archive of Career Buzz inspiring guest stories. So on June 12th, a couple of weeks ago, we had the inspiring career stories of a few internationally educated professionals, Dr. Shalini Anthwal and Maria Belmasova, and they had participated in a program at U of T's Rotman School called Business Edge, and we had Adam Buckley from that program. If you're an internationally educated professional, that was a really interesting story, and especially Maria had a lot to say about her journey from Kazakhstan to her university degree in Siberia before moving to Toronto. And what she did and didn't do that worked and didn't work when she got here. So have a look. It's the Career Buzz button on careercycles.com, and you can catch that the archive of amazing and inspiring guests. So many of us now are watching TED Talks. We watch for inspiration and for learning. How do the speakers get selected? Emma Brooks' day job is a digital strategist with Publicist Modem, where she works with clients like Rogers Metro and Chrysler Canada. But her volunteer gig for the past 4 years is with TEDx Toronto. And most recently, she's the director of programming. Drew Dudley's TED Talk, called Everyday Leadership, has been watched by a million people. Drew's the former national chair of Canada's largest fundraiser for post-secondary students called Shinerama. He's now founder of Nuance Leadership and works with organizations to develop their leadership capacity. Drew appeared in the Huffington Post, Forbes.com, and his TED Talk was actually on the main page of TED.com. Emma Brooks and Drew Dudley both join me by phone. Emma and Drew, welcome to Career Buzz.
Thank you.
Oh, it's great to be here.
Good. Okay, we got you. You're both in different places, but glad you could make it. Emma, first, let me start with you. What you're doing all these interesting things. You're working with an agency, and you're also doing this work with TEDx Toronto. What do you like about your work life these days?
My work life really ladders up to a lot of the passions I have. I'm really passionate about digital and how it can play out in everyone's lives. I've also been passionate about advertising since I was about 15. So really nice intersection. But one of the things I've recently recognized that I really have great heart for are amazing ideas. And so that's kind of where TED comes in and allows me to fulfill my desire to be around great ideas.
Right on. And for you to be successful in your ad career and working with TEDx, what skills or strengths do you draw on?
I'm a lot of it's research and understanding consumer behavior and the way that they use digital, and you know, also technology and understanding how technology works and also how people are using technology in their day-to-day lives. But also a big part of it is telling stories to our clients to help them help sell through an idea is a really big part of what I do.
Right on. And Drew Dudley, so you're doing all kinds of things now. I know you're doing more public speaking and you're providing consulting. What are you liking about your work life?
Well, what I like about my work life, to start with, everything. I think the great thing about what I get to do is the fact that it's always a different environment. You're always getting a chance to connect with a different group of people who have different passions and tell different stories. And as a result, what I love is that I get a chance to have other people's stories and experiences further inform mine, and then I get to sort of carry their ideas and experiences forward to another organization or another group of people and sort of spread it that way as well. So it's almost like the pollination of ideas that I love coming, going and spreading the things that I believe in. But it's nice to, every time I work with a new group, they change how I feel about things, and then I can go and embrace sort of those ideas and spread them somewhere else. So that's the best part. What I love about my work now is that basically I can't really think of much I don't, to be honest.
Nice. And I like the way you put it, pollination of ideas. There's one skill you use. What other skills do you use to be successful in your career?
Well, I think Emma hit it on the head, and she talked about the importance of storytelling. And I was lucky enough to work with a great guy named James Miskalik, and we did an interview with him. He does a blog called 6 Months in Sudan, which is just an amazing, amazing site. And he told me that the story is the basic unit of human understanding. And I've always loved that fact because I think that understanding, no matter at what level, an understanding of the person, understanding an organization, understanding a concept, always leads to improvement. And the fact that I think that storytelling is the basic block of understanding, for me, I think the ability to tell stories effectively, and not just tell stories, but be able to help people connect to why those stories matter to them, is probably the primary skill that I use in my work.
Great. All right, so let's find out what your stories are. Like, you know, how did you get here? How did all of this happen? Emma, you're doing a couple of different things. How did you get here? What are a couple of key turning points in your story that brought you to the present?
It's a great question. So I grew up in Halifax, knew I wanted to be in advertising for a long time. So Toronto it was. Toronto is sort of the hub of advertising. So booked a flight, came out to Toronto, did a bunch of interviews and cold calling, and finally landed myself a job at an ad agency, a digital ad agency. And that led me to realizing that digital advertising is really a great intersection of my passion points of advertising and digital. So I've continued along that path. I'm just, you know, learning and growing as I go and taking opportunities. With regards to TEDx Toronto, I was lucky enough to know the two founders of TEDx Toronto back in 2009. And for 2010, the 2010 event, they asked me to get involved from a volunteer standpoint. I absolutely knew that was something I wanted to take. And 4 years later, I'm still involved and still loving it.
Emma, just to draw on something we talked about in the first half of the show, we were talking a little bit about internships. Did you need an internship or an unpaid internship at the beginning of your advertising career?
I didn't. I actually picked a university, Dalhousie, that had a mandatory co-op, and I did that because I did recognize the value of having sort of those four-month internships. They were paid internships. When I first moved out to Toronto, something that I did offer to one company I was really trying to get into was to work for free. They were gracious enough to say, you know, we recognize that you've got some talent we want to use, and we're willing to offer you an internship that wasn't, you know, great paying, but it was a paying gig. Fortunately, I was able to get a full-time job, so didn't need to take that. But it was something I was willing to do.
Great. Congratulations on getting through to that. There's probably some inspiring steps there to get that first job, because that actually is quite challenging for many recent grads.
Yeah.
And Drew Dudley, what about you? How, you know, you we'll find out in a little bit. I'll ask you a little bit more later how the TED Talk changed your career and life. But how did you start out? What was the first few steps in your career?
You know, I discovered that almost everything in our lives, whether it's work life or romantic life or personal development, there's basically a constant cycle of five things. And it's the first step, and then the next step, the wrong step, the step back, and then, you know, a step into something new. And when I left, the first step for me was to get out of school. And, you know, there's this real strong temptation, especially when you're good at it, to just keep getting degrees. And eventually, you know, you'll get out and every degree you get is going to mean that you start your career making more money, which to some degree is true. But, you know, you're watching people run up $150,000 debt before they start. So that first step for me was saying, okay, I'm actually going to enter the workforce. And for me, it was into fundraising, because at university, I got heavily involved in Shinerama, Students Fighting Cystic Fibrosis, and we did a couple of other scholarship funds and charity campaigns in memory of some friends that we lost. So my first step was saying, you know what, I'm not going to keep adding letters after my name. I'm going to actually enter the workforce, which when you're doing extremely well in school can sometimes, you know, you get pushback from your professors and others. So my first step was there. And then the next step was when I realized it wasn't fundraising that I loved. It was working with groups of people to achieve projects. It just so happened that all the projects I had worked on had been fundraising. And once I got into professional fundraising, I realized that, wow, I don't actually like fundraising that much. I miss working with developing young people. So that next step for me was then deciding to make a career change. And that, in many ways, sticking with it a little too long was what I would call the wrong step. Because what happens is, once I started in the career, the new career of student development and running the leadership development program, I loved it. And there was a lot of passion, a lot of momentum. And as that, what happened is that passion eventually plateaus 4 or 5 years in, but the money and the promotions, they continue to go up as you go into your career, and yet sort of happiness and satisfaction and excitement can plateau a little bit, but you're supposed to be chasing the money and the promotion. So my wrong step was thinking, well, I have all of these things I'm supposed to want, and I wasn't feeling that same passion. And I met a woman on a train trip who was going all the way across Canada to meet a guy that she met on the internet. And I said, oh. And she said, I know everyone thinks I'm crazy, but look, we adore each other for 3 years. We've talked every day, but we're both afraid of flying. And this is the only way we'll ever get to see each other in person. And she said, I don't know if everyone's entitled to a love story, but I want one, and I'll go as far as I have to get it. And she said, Drew, how far would you be willing to go for the chance to be happier? And that question really hit me at that point in my career, saying, you know, I liked my job. It was okay. But I wasn't willing to risk going and trying something new because I was afraid I'd end up with less than I had. And I thought, I kind of like what I have. So I'm not going to settle. I want the chance to be happier. And so I took that step back and was willing to take a new step forward and say, I'm going to try and do what I love. Because I read these things that say, you know, it's not money and promotions that determine your happiness with your career. It's how much control you have. And now I'm able to have complete control over my work. So it's been that cycle of taking that first step and then the next step, which is scary because you can't go back. You know, taking the wrong step, being willing to step back, and then again stepping forward instead of going all the way back to the beginning. So my career's kind of cycled like that.
That's great, Drew. And it's a good story, the train trip story and the question she asks, how far would you go for a chance to be happier? And it's probably an important question that anybody can ask themselves. There's this you know, idea, there's good and there's better, and you know, good can then be the enemy of better. And you know, maybe it was not quite good enough is the story that you're telling us. There was a divergence somewhere there.
Yeah, I think so. I think that you can't lead others till you lead yourself, and that means not settling in any part of your life.
Right on.
No matter how old you are, you're too young to settle.
We are talking to Drew Dudley. His TED Talk, Everyday Leadership, has been watched by a million people. And we're also talking to Emma Brooks. She's the Director of Programming for TEDx Toronto. I'm your host, Mark Franklin, on Career Buzz on CIUT 89.5 FM and worldwide CIUT.FM. Emma, you've been now working with the TEDx Toronto folks for a while. How do you guys select speakers?
We do two ways of selecting speakers. We have a programming team that's quite broad and diverse and very well connected to our city. And we also look outside of our programming team as well. So the programming team will brainstorm speakers. We definitely keep an eye out throughout the year of interesting news articles or stories that are appearing around us and sort of take stock of those names and think maybe they might be someone we might want to approach when we're looking to actually start booking speakers. So we do that, but we also look to the community. We know that, you know, our speakers are only going to be as good as far as we go outside, and however many suggestions we get are great. So we have community nominations and applications, which means speakers can apply to speak, or that they can be nominated by a friend or a colleague. And we look at those two and evaluate those across the set of criteria in tandem with the programming suggested list.
How many people want to speak at a TED Talk? Like you're going to have one, I believe, in the fall of this year. How many applicants do you expect, and how many spots are there?
So we're looking at probably 10 to 13 speakers this year. And we had over 550 applications and nominations this year. So that was quite a number for us to sort through and really evaluate. But we do our due diligence, and we definitely have, you know, seven different criteria we evaluate every speaker against to give everyone a fair opportunity. And then the programming team also came up with a list of about 150 potential speakers. So we had about 700 people.
So what are those criteria? What can you share with us about those criteria?
Yeah, so one of the great things about TEDx Toronto is we live in this amazing city with so many wonderful and great people around with fantastic ideas. So one of the things we really try to do is focus on Toronto and the people from Toronto and the ideas in Toronto. And a lot of other TEDxes may not do that. Some TEDxes will just fly in people from wherever, but we are so lucky to live in such a great city that we really do want to pull from our own backyard. And so we look at the connection to Toronto, whether the person grew up in Toronto, is from Toronto, went to school in Toronto, or if we feel that the idea is very specific to what's happening right now in the dialogue that's happening in Toronto. Some of the other things is whether we feel that they'll be able to effectively captivate an audience with their story, whether we feel, you know, a big thing is either do they have a new idea, or do they have an idea that takes conventional thought and turns it on its head. So we're really looking for something that's different, that makes you think, and really our delegates, which are the people they attend the day of, you know, where they walk out of there saying, you know, I never even thought about that, or I didn't even consider that, and really walk away inspired and ready to do something about it.
Right on. So it's quite astonishing to think about all the people who want to speak. And versus the 10 or 13 spots that you have.
Yeah.
So Drew Dudley, you jumped through the hoops, right? Whenever you did that, you got through and you spoke at that TED Talk. What led you to want to do that in the first place?
You know, my first TED Talk was Ken Robinson's. The first one I saw was Ken Robinson's Do Schools Kill Creativity, which I think is the most viewed of all time. One of my students sent it to me. And, you know, with a big, you know, 8 exclamation points saying, you have to watch this. And I didn't for 3 weeks until one night I was cleaning out my inbox and said, well, I'll watch it. And it just dropped my jaw, and I never heard of TED. And I spent the next 4 hours instead of working watching these talks. And instantly I said, I want to do this. And I started using them in my workshops for students. So two of my students came running in the summer of 2010 saying, there's a TED here in Toronto. And there's two open, I think they told me there was 2 open community slots. And said, we know that on your list of things to do while you're alive, I don't like saying before I die, you want to do a TED Talk. And you said that. Here's your chance. We'll nominate you. And I was a little intimidated by that. I was a lot intimidated by that. So I said, no, I'm just a part-time speaker. And I'd always told my students, you're not allowed to say you're just anything. It gives people permission to expect less from you. And so they were having none of that. So they started a poster campaign and a social media campaign to get people to nominate me. And so you say, I jumped through the hoops. Honestly, the students I worked with knew this was something I was working towards. And when the opportunity arose, they wouldn't let me chicken out. They really pushed me hard. And so I ended up doing a sample video and sending it in. And they sat and were the audience for it. And they told me that a couple of dozen of them might have nominated me. I don't know the actual number. And that's how it ended up. Like, some people who cared about my dream pushed me to not miss the chance to go after it,
That's great. I was curious about that intimidation and how people feel before they're going to go. And, you know, it's your few minutes of fame there, and then it may get picked up as yours did and get on the main page of TED.com. You know, how did you feel just immediately leading up to it when you were on the day of?
You know, I love to speak. Nothing, it's how I enter the world. Nothing makes me happier. But I hate the 20 minutes before I speak. And I've never hated 20 minutes more than TEDx Toronto. And the sad thing is it's such an amazing event and it's run so well by incredible people that I wish I remembered it better. But I was terrified. And you know what? I was backstage with brilliant people. I mean, Soul Guy was speaking too, and he was pacing back and forth. We were sharing a hallway. And these are people who, you know, he's performed for tens of thousands of people as part of his career. So it's really nerve-wracking. Those three letters will really mess with your head. And the best speakers I know and the most confident and really brilliant people, we let the three letters get in our head. But once you get out there, and the audience wants you to succeed so badly, and the support that you get from the organizers is so stupendous that once you get going, it's... I've never been more nervous than I was for TED. And, you know, I almost didn't tell the story I told because I didn't think it had enough gravitas for TED.
Yeah. You seemed very calm. Like, I watched that TED talk, and I'm sure, you know, listeners, go check it out. Go find Drew Dudley on TED. You seemed pretty calm and collected. That's what, and I wanted to ask you that question on the air here to see how, if you were feeling terrified.
Then I deserve an Oscar because... I'll tell you, when I walk out on stage, and I'd say this when I help other speakers prepare now, I didn't perform very often on stages like that. So when you walk down on the stage and the spotlights hit you, I understand the concept deer in the headlights now because I never had that kind of lighting before. And you can't see the audience.
Yes.
And honestly, if you could go inside my head while I'm delivering that presentation, all you would hear is a high-pitched, sustained scream, which is why the talk is so quick. It's so fast.
It was quick, exactly. Yeah. So, Emma, from your perspective, I mean, you I don't know if you were part of the team that picked Drew at the time, but what makes somebody like Drew and his talk attractive? How did he jump through the hoops from the TED selection committee?
So I wasn't on programming that year, but I don't know if Drew knows this. I was backstage with Drew right before he went on. I can attest he was a nervous wreck. And what we do is we really look for, you know, Drew's idea for us was so accessible to everyone. It was something that we said anyone can take this and action it themselves. This idea that leadership is not meant to be on a pedestal. It is something that everyone can be. To us was changing this idea in our head of what is a leader. And we really grabbed onto that.
That's great. From your perspective, Emma, now that you've been watching these TED Talks, you've been involved in them, how has being involved in all of this changed your own career and life?
It's been immensely helpful, especially from the programming standpoint. As I said earlier, storytelling is a big part of what I do, and it's something I'm still learning how to do effectively for our clients. Being able to sit in a room, you know, we have speaker coaches that we work we have them work really closely with our speakers to help develop their talks. There's quite intensive periods where a speaker coach and a speaker will sit down 2-3 hours at a time over several different days, really getting that story right. And being able to be a part of that process and understanding how a story comes together and how to construct a story so it has the right pacing, it has the right ebb and flow, has been immensely helpful in my day-to-day as I tell stories to my clients.
Right on. And I know if people want to get started, you know, you don't have to start with TED Talk. There's lots of places, even in Toronto, there's lots of places to do talks. I know there's that Raconteurs group that I've been to once or twice. So you don't have to start right at the top if listeners are sort of saying, gee, I'd love to do that. You don't have to start right there. Now, Drew, what happened? After this TED Talk, a lot of people watched that talk. What was the feedback? What happened to you in the immediate aftermath of doing that TED Talk?
You know, I do remember seeing Emma backstage. Actually, I remember Emma was, I think, the first person I talked to, she and a colleague of hers. And right away, they were so wonderfully receptive. I think Emma looked at me and said, goosebumps, goosebumps. And I don't really remember much after I got off the stage, but there was such an overwhelming response immediately on Twitter, which I had just joined. And I actually got an email right away from a speaking agency who was there to see one of their other speakers. And they instantly invited me to join their roster, which opened up an entire new career in terms of speaking to corporate audiences. You know, about 10,000 people watched that talk in the year or so after TEDx Toronto, which I was thrilled with. It was when it went on to TED.com, and I think about 200,000 people watched it over a weekend, that, you know, there started to be some real international interest. So for me, you know, I decided to leave my job in July, and I got to speak at TED in September. And, you know, people try to come out of the block strong with their new career. TED was sort of a cannon that I got lucky enough to step into right before I started a new career. And it launched me, and it really allowed me to start building momentum on a talent that I already had. But it was really fortunate, and it wasn't part of the plan. And I tell a lot of people, look, we get wrapped up in 5-year plans, and I think plans are important. But sometimes I think we shouldn't focus on 5-year plans. We should focus on building 5-year momentum.
Right.
And sometimes
right on.
Opportunities you don't know are going to come along, but as long as you've developed the momentum, you'll be ready for
right
it.
Right on. Great stories, guys. We're going to have to leave it there. We're run out of time. If people want to find out more, Emma, they want to find out about TED Toronto, how do they do that? Oh, we might have lost Emma. I think it's TEDxToronto.com. And Drew, if people want to find out more about you, how do they do that? Oh, no, they're gone. All right, just Google Drew Dudley and you'll find out more. Thanks to my guests today. We were talking to Emma Brooks and Drew Dudley and also Barbara Moses here on Career Buzz.